Luke chapter 12, starting at verse 35. Stay dressed for action and keep your lamps burning, and be like men who are waiting for their master to come home from the wedding feast, so that they may open the door to him at once when he comes and knocks. Blessed are those servants whom the master finds awake when he comes. Truly, I say to you, he will dress himself for service and have them recline at table, and he will come and serve them. If he comes in the second watch or in the third and finds them awake, blessed are those servants. But know this, that if the master of the house had known at what hour the thief was coming, he would not have left his house to be broken into. You also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Peter said, Lord, are you telling this parable for us or for all? And the Lord said, Who then is the faithful and wise manager whom his master will set over his household to give them their portion of food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly, I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if that servant says to himself, My master is delayed in coming, and begins to beat the male and female servants, and to eat and drink and get drunk, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour that he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and put him with the unfaithful. And that servant who knew his master's will, but did not get ready or act according to his will receive a severe beating. But the one who did not know and did what deserved a beating will receive a light beating. Everyone to whom much was given, of him much will be required. And from him to whom they entrusted much, they will demand the more. I came to cast fire on the earth, and would that it were already kindled. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how great is my distress until it is accomplished. Do you think that I have come to give peace on earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. For from now on, in one house there will be five divided, three against two, and two against three. They will be divided father against son, and son against father, mother against daughter, and daughter against mother, mother-in-law against daughter-in-law, and daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. He also said to the crowds, When you see a cloud rising in the west, you say at once, A shower is coming, and so it happens. And when you see the south wind blowing, you say, There will be scorching heat, and it happens. You hypocrites, you know how to interpret the appearance of the earth and sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time? And why do you not judge for yourselves what is right? As you go with your accuser before the magistrate, make an effort to settle with him on the way, lest he drag you to the judge, and the judge hand you over to the officer, and the officer put you in prison. I tell you, you will never get out until you have paid the very last penny. There were some present at the very time who told him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices, and he answered them, Do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans, because they suffered in this way? No, I tell you, but unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. All those 18 on whom the tower in Siloam fell and killed them, do you think that they were worse offenders than all the others who lived in Jerusalem? No, I tell you, but unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. And he told them this parable. A man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came seeking fruit on it and found none. And he said to the vine dresser, Look, for 3 years now I have come seeking fruit on this fig tree, and I find none. Cut it down. Why should it use up the ground? And he answered him, Sir, let it alone this year also, until I dig round it and put on manure. Then, if it should bear fruit next year, well and good, but if not, you can cut it down.
Talk about the coming of the Lord on May 21st. You're not just saying this is a strong likelihood. You're saying absolutely this is going to happen.
I am saying this is going to happen. May 21, Judgment Day will begin. But thank you for calling and sharing. And shall we take our next call, please? Welcome to Open Forum.
Hi, this is Andrew.
Yeah.
I have a question about May 21st. I'm just curious, if I was coming to California, you would sign a contract to me that you would make all your possessions this
Now, excuse me. May 21 is the day of judgment. It is a terrible day of destruction all over the world. Under no circumstance it is business as usual.
Can you tell me about the great earthquake that is going to hit and exactly what is going to happen?
Whenever a city or an area of the world comes to 6 p.m. standard time, about that time, and it's May 21 on their calendar, and there's going to be a great earthquake in that city. Now, whether it's going to be a whole series of earthquakes up and down from north to south, we don't know. The fact is that you should be praying and begging God that you might be one of those that are to be raptured. But those who are left behind, it is going to be a super, super horror story. An earthquake far larger, far greater than anything that has ever happened. And if you are thinking, well, then it's going to somehow be business as usual, you are going to be bitterly disappointed, because it will not be. And then when the next city is 6 p.m., they will have their earthquake. And every time there is a great earthquake, it means that Judgment Day has come to that area. And so I don't even want to think about those kind of things that you're suggesting. But thank you for calling and sharing. And shall we take our next call, please? Welcome to Open Forum. There's only 13 days left. Can you imagine it? What's going to happen 13 days from now?
Good to see you. Really glad that you've been able to join us at Euston Church this evening. That was Harold Camping. I don't know if you remember, he was the guy who claimed that Judgment Day was coming on the 21st of May 2011, which obviously turned out not to be the case. But how wrong was he? Just have a look at verse 40 of our reading. So verse 40, he's wrong on the last seven words. He's totally wrong on those final seven words, isn't he? Jesus says very clearly, at an hour you do not expect. But lots of the other stuff that guy Harold Camping described is actually exactly the language of the passage here. So the coming of the Lord, a day of judgment for some horror story. Definitely not business as usual. Verse 40, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming. Well, that's the headline for where we'll be this evening. Jesus is still in the same sermon that we've been listening to him preach for the last 2 weeks. It's a sermon that began just over the page at the beginning of chapter 12, verse 1. In verse 5 of chapter 12, we saw Jesus talk about the reality of hell. And in verse 8 of chapter 12, he talked about a day in the future when you'll meet Jesus in the presence of the angels, and Jesus will either deny you on that day or acknowledge you and welcome you into his family. They're really big eternal truths that Jesus is talking about here, and Jesus knows that we find them difficult to focus on. That's why last week we saw Jesus having to clear the decks. One of the big things that makes it difficult for us to focus on these things is our obsession with material things and this world. Well, today Jesus is engaging with another factor that makes it hard for us to focus on seeking his kingdom, and that is the delay in his kingdom coming. Verse 38 suggests it might be a long delay. The master might not come back till the second or third watch of the night. And in verse 45, the delay is so long that some people take it as a sign that it's okay to go completely off the rails, which is not a safe thing to do, because the Son of Man is coming. I don't know if you remember when that Harold Camping guy was on the TV a couple of years ago. There's loads of clips on YouTube. You can see news clips, actually, the newscasters having a good old laugh together at the things that he said. I mean, obviously they think that he is a crazy, and in many ways he comes across like that. But actually, lots of the language that he uses, as we said, comes straight from this passage, and actually means that we would be mocked if we were Christian people saying lots of those things as well. Yeah, we don't go on about the date. Jesus is clear that we shouldn't. But I remember at a little event, I think it was at BJ's house last year, some of us put on a little event to invite some friends to hear a bit of the Christian message. And I could, having this great conversation with someone, I could see that she thought I sounded fairly sensible when I was talking about the historical reliability of the New Testament. And then her eyes start to glaze over as I talked about the end of the world. I think she was thinking, yeah, he is a crazy fundamentalist after all. And I don't know, maybe even if you're a Christian, you mock your own heart for believing this stuff. Are we crazy? You know, we want it to be true, but 2,000 years just feels like an awfully long time, doesn't it? It shakes our faith when we think about that, doesn't it? Another year goes by, another decade, another century. Maybe it will be another millennium. Is he really coming? Well, Luke wants us to be certain about the things of the kingdom, and so it's not surprising that Luke would want to reassure us about this awkward thing that is the delay in Jesus coming. Yeah, you certainly will not know when it will happen, but verse 40, you can be certain of this, the Son of Man is coming. We'll see as we get into the detail here, that it will be a great day, and it will be a terrible day. Well, our first point is for faithful followers of Jesus, and the point is to encourage us to stay ready. I love the way that Jesus generally does this. He always loves to prepare us for the realities of what life will be like when he's not here. That's one of the big things in Luke's Gospel. We'll see more verses that prepare us as we go on in Luke from what might well be a very long delay. Verse 38 is one of those verses. If he comes in the second watch or in the third, by the third watch, you're basically talking about waiting till the next day. I don't know if you've ever been babysitting for friends, and you know they say we'll be back around 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock comes and goes. 10:30 comes and goes. 11 o'clock, still no sign of them. At 11:30 you think, well, the kids are in bed, I think I'll just pop home and it'll all be fine. You ever done that? Only kidding. just been struck off the babysitting rota. But it's that kind of feeling. Are we going to have to stay on watch here for the whole night? Verse 36, it's really the language of the White House butler. So the Obamas are out at a wedding. It's one of those weddings that could go on for days or certainly hours. You know, maybe it's going to be one of those where they expect everyone to stay till the end and do one of those silly arches that the bride and groom have to walk through in an undignified way. Well, Obama's at this wedding and he's been distracted. George Osborne's at the wedding and Obama felt he'd better go and apologise for getting his name wrong at the G8. They get into a little bit of politics chat. It goes midnight. It goes 3 o'clock. It goes 4 o'clock. And yet our butler, do you know where he is? He's standing at the front door of the White House. The lights are on. And he's got his hands on the other side of the door all of this time, just waiting. No one's going to have to ring the bell, because as soon as that car pulls up, whatever time it happens, he'll fling the door open. At your service, sir. Ready and waiting. Well, that's Jesus' illustration for what it's like to persevere in the Christian life. To be a servant of Jesus means this constant readiness for his arrival, even if that will be a very long time in coming. Well, in practice, what will that mean? Well, it'll mean the kinds of things that Jesus talks about towards the end of our reading, at least, it will mean being a repentant person. It will mean serving, verse 42, being about the master's business. We know what that is from last week, seeking his kingdom. And actually, loads of the things that we've already been told to do in Luke's gospel only make sense, and we'll only really be able to do them if we have that focus of waiting the master's coming. So why would you take up your cross and follow Jesus in the way of the cross if you didn't think he was coming back in glory? You won't be motivated by a day when you'll be acknowledged before the angels if you don't think he's coming back. You won't pray the prayer, "Your kingdom come," if you don't think he's coming. I think partly we can see what it means to be ready from the opposite reaction. So down in verse 47, this other servant who knew his master's will but didn't get ready or act according to his will. Act according to Jesus' will. It's very simple on one level. Obviously we'll always fail. We'll every day have to say sorry. But every day, trying to live according to the master's will and organising our lives around the kind of things he wants us to pray. Hallowed be your name, your kingdom come. This won't mean batten down the hatches, Harold Camping style. Apparently on the day it happened he was kind of behind his house, curtains all closed, batten down the hatches in that kind of way. To be ready for Jesus will look a lot more ordinary. It'll mean just usually carrying on, being a student or a worker, a family member or a friend, but being one of those things who's living in the light of the fact that the Master is coming. The world will definitely think you're mad if you do that. They'll think you're as mad as the old bloke on the film. And actually, even some people who call themselves Christian or say that they're warm toward Jesus will consider you to be overkeen if you really live like this. You know, that butler at the White House, you know, some of the other servants, imagine waiting there, standing for hours, holding the door, ready to open it. You know, that's a bit overkeen, isn't it? Well, what does the master think of that kind of behaviour? Verse 37. And this is, look at this verse for me, because it's blown me away a little bit this week. Blessed are those servants who the master finds awake when he comes. Truly I say to you, he will dress himself for service and have them recline at table, and he will come and serve them. Can you see why that would blow me away a little bit? At first I thought I was reading it wrong, that it was saying they serve him. I checked in several commentaries to make sure I was reading it the right way. And actually it's not that surprising, is it? We know Jesus is among us to serve. He says that about himself. Think of him washing the disciples' feet. But it still blows me away to think of this, that when Jesus comes back, he will want to serve you and me if we've been his faithful servants. So back to our White House butler, as he opens the door and says, "At your service," the president actually says to him, "No, I'm at yours." As the most important man in the world rolls up his sleeves, goes to the kitchen, prepares an amazing meal, and brings it to his butler on a tray in the state dining room. Enjoy my favour. Be happy. Because I'm happy that you've been so faithful. I don't know how you feel about that, but doesn't the grace of Jesus just blow you away? Why would he do that for people like us who are so undeserving? Any faithfulness we have will only be in his strength anyway. And yet he wants to bless us and serve us. It is picture language, this. I don't know exactly what that kind of banquet meal mean, but it sounds amazing, doesn't it? Worth waiting for. And so I don't know when this week you'll question why you're living as someone waiting for Jesus to come back. Maybe it'll be a knockback as you invite someone to the pub quiz. Maybe a battle against temptation that you're just struggling with in an ongoing way. Maybe just the general weirdness of being the different one. Why am I doing it? Well, think of a day when Jesus meets you and he's pleased with you and he sits you down to serve you at a banquet that will last forever. I think we really need that motivation, you know. It's It's hard to stay keen as a Christian for the whole of a lifetime. My personal experience is it gets harder, actually, as you get older. And I'm certainly at the age where I could list you several friends who sadly have given up staying awake and being ready for the Master coming. Well, I hope this second point will persuade you that that's a very dangerous and unwise thing for them to have done. I should warn you, point two is pretty horrible. And it seems to be directed at people who've basically given up serving Jesus or taken the delay as a sign that it would be safe to do that. So point two is to those who end up being unfaithful followers. Peter down in verse 41 asks this good question. Peter said, "Lord, are you telling this parable for us or for all?" Peter's done the sort of tools for Bible handling thing. He knows that you've got to ask, who am I? Am I in this passage? Is it talking to me, or is it talking to other people? And Jesus doesn't give a direct answer, but by verse 48, it's pretty clear that there's a broad reach in what he's saying here. Second half of verse 48, "Everyone to whom much was given, of him much will be required, and from him to whom they entrusted much, they will demand the more." So it seems partly to be about responsibility that people have been given, but mainly actually about knowledge. Now you can see that from verse 47, "The servant who knew his master's will but didn't get ready or act according to his will receive a severe beating, but the one who did not know and did what deserved a beating will receive a light beating." So yeah, this has something to say to apostles. Obviously they know more about Jesus than we do. But anyone who knows stuff is in the reach of who Jesus is talking to here. And it does seem like the more knowledge you have, whether that's because of your background or heritage or responsibility as a Christian teacher, the more this will apply to you. And you could see how it could happen, couldn't you? Verse 45. Look what this servant said to himself. "My master is delayed in coming." And he began to beat the male and female servants and to eat and drink and get drunk. Back in the White House, this is the butler who thinks, well, this master is delayed. This delay is stretching out into a very long time. I think I can just forget my responsibilities here. He kills the president's dog. He starts to beat up on the president's staff. And he goes into the Oval Office, where in the outbox is a load of instructions that the president has given that this servant puts straight into the shredder. Well, that would be an outrageous thing, wouldn't it? Well, see what happens to him when the master returns. Verse 46, it's so graphic, isn't it? "The master of the servant will come on a day when he doesn't expect him, and at an hour he doesn't know, and will cut him in pieces and put him with the unfaithful." Verse 47 puts it another way. "That servant who knew his master's will but didn't get ready or act according to his will receive a severe beating." And I'm aware that this sounds very strong, doesn't it, when we start to translate that into reality and into a parable that's about judgment. It is just worth us noticing a few things. First is that this is proportional. This has been an outrageous betrayal. Of course, there has to be a very strong response. It's the punishment fits the crime. He beat up people. He got beaten up as his punishment. This is a master, remember, who cares about justice when we're talking about Jesus. What else would you expect him to do? As I say, it's picture language. But it's very strong. And I think it is worth saying that people find judgment offensive, don't they? But wouldn't a world where the master lets wicked servants run riot permanently be more offensive if God never came back and held people to account? It's a good thing that there'll be a day of accountability for people who run riot in God's world. And we need to be really clear here. The aim in this point is not to send genuine Christians into a guilt trip. It's for people who've taken the delay as evidence that they're quite safe to stick two fingers up to Jesus. There's no day of reckoning. Verse 47, my master is delayed in coming. Well, who is this when we translate it to the real world? At the very least, this is someone who's had the gospel clearly delivered to them. Maybe there were people who were taught when they were young and then drifted away from Christian things, had a Christian heritage, had the knowledge, maybe went to a Christian school, but it didn't translate into any kind of performance. Maybe they did the Christianity Explored course more than once. Maybe this is someone who was a keen member of a midweek group while they were a student. Maybe they were even a leader. And there was no big dramatic two fingers up to Jesus for that sort of person. It was just that they drifted into that relationship that they knew was inappropriate for someone who served this master. Or it might just have been the ordinary cares of this world that dulled them to what Jesus thought was important. They stopped seeking his kingdom. And they stopped living according to his will. I think it is worth saying at this point, this is a real warning. It might be a warning to some of us in the room. I guess there might be some of us who might be on the verge of something that you know is seriously ungodly, something you know would be disobedient when you know what the will of Jesus is. Well, wake up is the message from Jesus here. You're on a dangerous path if that's you. You'll be counted among the unfaithful if you carry on that path. Don't think you'll be safe just because at one time you called Jesus master or because you had the knowledge. And don't run to verse 48. It's one of those verses you kind of want to run to, isn't it? Maybe I'm the one who doesn't know very much. Maybe that means that I'll just deserve a light beating. Well, if you're hearing Jesus teach this parable to you clearly, it means that you're one of the ones who's in the know. It's very sobering stuff. And the contrast, remember what we said Jesus will do when he comes back in the first point? It's just so stark, isn't it? Do you want Jesus to serve you at a banquet that will last forever? Or do you want him to kick you out in the cold, in pieces? It's picture language, yeah. But it's a picture of something real. Jesus isn't trying to frighten us cruelly as he speaks like this. This is him speaking the truth in love to us. He knows that this delay could potentially be very dangerous for our commitment to him. And so he wants to warn us to wake up. It's so clear, isn't it, when you see the consequences? What side do you want to be on? Well, it's worth saying as well not to panic. I'm aware that when we read something like that, if we're a Christian, we might think, gosh, how I might end up being that unfaithful servant. Well, it's very simple what to do to stay on track. You know the Master's will, it's in here. You know the Lord's Prayer, the things that he thinks are important. Keep in those things, and you'll be faithful. And Jesus will serve you one day. And Dusa, it's worth saying as well to those who are leaving us, it's sad always to hear of folk moving on. Others are as well this summer. Do please end up at a church that will help to keep you faithful. I hope I wouldn't have to say any more from this passage about how important that would be. Well, Jesus is the most divisive person in history. Everyone stands or falls on their response to him. The challenge for everyone is to line up behind Jesus. That's the reason why you get those divided families that our passage goes on to mention. And this final point is really one that reminds us that everyone needs to respond to this urgently. Whoever you are, don't take comfort, but respond in urgency. These couple of paragraphs about the weather and the accuser, we don't have time to look at them really. They're stories that are basically meant to say, be sensible, read the signals. Read the signs. I'm telling you, you know how to interpret the weather. You should know how to interpret what I'm saying to you, says Jesus. You know how to sort out a dispute with an adversary. Sort yourself out on this one before it's too late. And that idea of before it's too late, that really is the agenda in the conversation in 13 verse 1 to 5. So 13 verse 1, they're having this conversation about the tragedies of the day. It's basically equivalent of opening up the papers with Jesus. Look at the horror of the world. Verse 1. There were some present at that very time who told him about the Galileans, whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. Pilate is the foreign dictator, and the sacrifices mentioned there tell you that the people who died were conducting their most precious religious ceremonies at the time, until Pilate's troops burst in and butchered him, and it made such a mess that you couldn't tell the difference between the lamb's blood from the sacrifices and the human blood by the end of it. And then verse 4, this tower disaster, kind of a mini September the 11th of its day. A tower has fallen down. We're not told why, but the tower has fallen. And death reaches out, claims 18 more victims. It's the world we recognise, isn't it? It's the newspapers every day. Jesus has asked the question about exactly the world we know. And this really is the conversation in the pub, or people looking at the internet or metro together in the office as those things come up in the news. And Jesus kind of just cuts through it all here and gets to what's really important. Verse 4, of those 18, or those 18 on whom the tower in Siloam fell and killed them, do you think that they were worse offenders than all the others who lived in Jerusalem? No, I tell you, but unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. It's a very common worldview that Jesus engages with there. What have I done wrong that means this suffering has happened to me? What have they done wrong that means that happened to them? Or at least maybe we wouldn't say that, but we would maybe think the opposite. Well, lucky me that I didn't get into that situation. Jesus really helpfully here says that suffering isn't personal. It's an important part of our answer on why the suffering in the world. And it's a fairly gentle response to that extent. But what he goes on to say doesn't sound so gentle, does it? We should know that this isn't Jesus' first response to people in the throes of suffering. Jesus weeps with those who are in the midst of grief. We know that as he sees the family of his friend Lazarus at his tomb. Now this is Jesus in a conversation with, I guess if you like, the detached observers. We're watching it on the TV screen in the pub, or we're just talking about it in the office. And Jesus says so strongly, you might not have been swept away by the tsunami, but you're on the same path of destruction that the people who were swept away were on. Twice he says it. Unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. Not to say that we're all murderers, but all of us rebel servants by nature. And Jesus is talking about hell here. We need to be clear about that. He says if you don't turn around, you're on the path to hell. And I'm aware that what I'm about to say just sounds so strong, but it does mean that if you did end up in hell, the fact that you died warm in your bed at a good old age, compared to the person next to you who was in one of the twin towers, well, that will be cold comfort if you ended up in hell. But you do have one major advantage over the person who died in the twin towers. You're still alive, and you still have time to repent. So please do the thing that Jesus tells you to do here if you haven't done it yet. Unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. Turn your life around and organise it around the fact that the Son of Man is coming back. It's a big thing to do that. It's a simple thing in a way. You could flick back to the Lord's Prayer, and if you say that prayer and mean it, that's the kind of prayer of a repentant person. Jesus couldn't be clearer how urgent it is that we would do that. They are strong verses that we've been looking at tonight. They're the kind of verses that kind of make me want to say sorry for mentioning them, to be honest. But sorry would be the wrong thing to say. because it's big, serious stuff, Christianity, and it's important that you know. I'm just quite challenged that I think we're quite laid back, aren't we, in the way that we present the gospel to people. We want to avoid looking like the Harold Camping crazy weirdos if we go around saying repent. I just wonder, do my family and friends who don't yet know Jesus, do they get the seriousness and the urgency of this in the way that I tell them the gospel? Jesus isn't a monster for talking like this. He wants to warn you, and he does that in love. And we know he does it in love because of these final few verses. Just look at verses 6 to 9. And these verses are, in this passage, the reason for the delay. Do you ever think much about that? I mean, it does just feel like a very long time, doesn't it? If Jesus wants to sort the world out, bring his kingdom in, I mean, why doesn't he just come and do it? There's enough of a mess to sort out. There are different reasons, I guess, why people delay sometimes, aren't there? Sometimes it's incompetence. You know that if you've ever travelled on public transport in this country. Sometimes the delay is just a lack of will, really, ever to do the thing that they said they were going to come and do. Sometimes it's a good reason. And Jesus has a good reason for his delay. I'm going to read verses 6 to 9. See if you can spot the reason. And he told this parable. A man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came seeking fruit on it, and found none. And he said to the vine dresser, "Look, for 3 years now I've come seeking fruit on this fig tree, and I find none. Cut it down. Why should it use up the ground?" And he answered him, "Sir, let it alone this year also, until I dig around it and put on manure. Then if it should bear fruit next year, well and good. But if not, you can come and cut it down." You see Jesus' reason? Jesus says, "I am the vine dresser, and the reason that I'm delaying is, well, let's just give it a little bit more time and see if any more response is forthcoming." This amazing thing basically means that the entire next era of human history is deliberately on hold because Jesus looks out on you and me and says, "Let's just give them a little bit more time." I don't know how you feel about that. It blows me away. God is so concerned about me, so much wants me not to perish, that he's delayed heaven and hell long enough to give me time to repent. I don't know if you ever played hide and seek when you were younger, or you know, one of those games where you've got to say, you know, count to 100 and ready or not, here I come. And you know, if you were like me, you counted really quickly so that you could get on and catch people. I think I sometimes think that God's a bit like that. God likes the judgment stuff. Can't wait to give people what's coming to them. Well, actually, this parable tells us that the opposite is true. Jesus doesn't like it. So he counts slowly to give more people time to repent. Will we bear fruit? That's the question. Jesus is doing the spiritual equivalent of pouring a bit of manure and fertilizer on us, see if anything takes hold. But we need to know that he won't wait forever. It is 5 minutes to midnight in the spectrum of eternity. And so please don't delay. Verse 40 again, "The Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." Don't hedge your bets on this one. It will be a terrible day, and it will be a great day. Remember where we started? Why does Jesus want you to repent? So that he can serve you. It's amazing. Jesus wants more people to repent so that he has more work to do of serving more people in his big heavenly banquet. Well, there's loads more we could say. There's lots more we can talk around. I hope we will afterwards. I'm conscious that it's huge stuff to chuck out there. And the implications are massive if you start to think about what this would mean for us as Christian people to live like this. But here's just a tiny thing for you to do tomorrow morning. If you're not a Christian, I hope it's clear enough what you need to do from this. I hope it's clear enough that the take-home thing for you is to repent. But if you are a Christian, and you wake up tomorrow morning, and Jesus hasn't come back yet, just Maybe just picture some of the different people that you might see during the course of your day. People you might see in your flat, on the bus, people you might work with, maybe family members. And then as you think about those people, think about Jesus, who holds back his kingdom for one reason only, because he's looking at them saying, let's just give them a little bit more time and see if anything comes of it. I wonder what it would mean for us to live like that tomorrow if Jesus is focused on that perspective. I guess it will mean I want to pray like mad for people more. This challenges me to be more urgent in prayer. Invite to that pub quiz. You know, for some people that could be the thing that hooks them in to this heavenly banquet. I wonder what it makes you want to do as you think of Jesus saying, let's just give them a little bit more time. Verse 40. You also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming.